This is a summary of Bleeding Out by bestbookbriefings.com. Bleeding Out: The Devastating Consequences of Urban Violence by Thomas Apt. 1. Bleeding Out. Imagine that you're a trauma surgeon, working a late-night shift in the emergency room. A young man is wheeled in on a gurney. He is unconscious and bleeding heavily from a gunshot wound. Without your assistance, he will die in minutes. What do you do? His clothes are old and ragged. He might be jobless or homeless. Do you start the treatment by getting him a job or an apartment? He has clearly been involved in some sort of violent event, and he might be dangerous. Do you alert security and tie him down? Obviously not. The only sensible course of action at this time is to stop the bleeding, because if you don't, nothing else is going to matter. Americans are killed at a rate that is 7 times higher than in other developed countries, due to a gun homicide rate that is 25 times higher. Urban violence accounts for more violent deaths than any other form of crime. It is a plague that affects the most vulnerable communities, but make no mistake, it is an issue of national concern. Triage. When a patient is brought into an emergency room, their vital signs are appraised in order to see how at risk they are. Patients with deadly injuries or illnesses receive immediate medical attention, and the others wait for their turn. The logic here is simple, but important: you cannot help everyone at the same time. Hospitals try to use their limited resources in the way that helps and saves as many people as possible. Violent injuries are triaged, but we fail to do the same for violence as a whole. Shootings and stabbings claim thousands of lives every year, but they are rarely a cause for concern with our politicians. Leave one young man to bleed out in the ER and there is hell to pay. Leave thousands of young men to die in their neighborhoods, and you're on track to be re-elected. Controlling urban violence is an incredibly unappreciated part of urban governance. Aside from the lives it takes, violent crimes pose an enormous financial and opportunity cost to the community. Concentrated poverty causes violence. Urban poverty is a blight that passes from generation to generation. Poor parents struggle to provide their children with new opportunities and the support they never received. Poor neighborhoods tend to stay poor. Housing is highly unstable, and schools are dropout factories. Access to jobs and transportation are severely limited as well. Taken individually, these challenges are daunting. If you add them up, they prove to be overwhelming. When poverty is concentrated, individuals, families, and communities are placed under intense and constant pressure. When this pressure persists, it leads to criminal activity and violence. Outsiders may find themselves asking, why would anyone want to stay in those circumstances? Why don't people leave and make a new start? Bluntly put, people stay because they have very little choice in the matter. One cannot examine concentrated urban poverty without acknowledging America's shameful history of racial segregation. During the 20th century, African Americans were deliberately pushed out from desirable neighborhoods and forced to live in places with inferior housing, schooling, and transportation. Discrimination stretched across the generations, building a concrete legacy of handicaps and obstacles designed to keep Black people there. When industries started leaving cities in the 60s, minority Americans were especially vulnerable to losing jobs. When outright racial segregation ended, middle-class whites and minorities migrated out of poor neighborhoods, thus further concentrating poverty among people of color and magnifying its impact. In Patrick Sharkey's book Stuck in Place, he shows that 70% of African Americans that live in the nation's poorest neighborhoods come from families that have been living there since the 60s. Urban violence preserves urban poverty. Urban violence is a vicious, self-escalating cycle, where violence begets violence and insult leads to a fistfight that leads to a shooting. But this cycle also perpetuates poverty if poor education, employment, housing, and health are the threads in the noose of concentrated poverty, then violence is the hand that is pulling it tightly closed. Violence produces fear that is rampantly toxic to people who are already struggling. In order to cope with the anger and anxiety that comes from living with violence, many adults turn to destructive behaviors like substance abuse, unprotected sex, and aggression. When they grow older, the stress catches up to them in the form of serious illnesses. Fear also causes avoidance in the face of danger. People will naturally try to relocate, refuse to visit, or refrain from investing. This is devastating for local businesses and local property values. This adds up to lower tax revenues, which means fewer public services. In short, urban violence kickstarts a brutal process that deepens and hardens the conditions that created it in the first place. Credible studies estimate the cost of one murder to be from $10 to $20 million in lost labor, property damage, medical and justice system costs. In total, the annual price tag of homicide ranges from $173 to $332 billion. These costs are passed on to the general public through taxes, elevated insurance rates, and economic impact. Put violence first. Now, since high rates of violence are caused by concentrated poverty, it's understandable to think that the best way to curb it is to address the root causes. The idea is that less poverty will lead to less violence. While there are clear correlations between crime, violence and poverty when you look at static, single points in time, incremental changes in wealth and inequality do not always correspond to changes in crime and violence. Root causes don't explain why crime and violence are concentrated in a small number of places and people. Many are poor, but fewer criminals, fewer still are killers. Most murderers may be poor, but the overwhelming majority of the poor are not murderers. Addressing root causes cannot stop the bleeding. Ending poverty and racism are important long-term goals, but they do not lead to concrete plans for action against violence. People who live with that reality need help right now. Urban violence is the linchpin for poverty. A measure of security needs to be established before recovery can begin. Anti-violence should not be a substitute for broader welfare improvement, but it can act as a short and medium-term bridge to longer-term solutions. 2. Sticky situations. Urban violence must be understood before it is treated. Murder rarely happens at random. Homicides happen in predictable places, and perpetuated by identifiable people who have been triggered by well-understood behaviors. If you can target these patterns, you can stop much of the killing. In 2015, half of America's gun homicides were concentrated in 127 cities, and more than 25% of them happened in neighborhoods that contained 1.5% of the U.S. population. In Oakland, 60% of murders take place inside a social network of 1 to 2,000 high-risk individuals. In New Orleans, a network of 600 to 700 people accounts for more than half of the total lethal encounters. Even within criminal groups, violence is not distributed evenly. In a group of 20 to 30 members, only 2 or 3 of them will reliably use a firearm in a conflict. Shooters are overwhelmingly young males with extensive juvenile and criminal histories. They tend to associate with other people in search of companionship and mutual protection, and many of them have substance abuse problems. In most cities, 4% of the blocks account for about 50% of crime hotspots, as they are often called. A hotspot might be a street corner where gang members often congregate, a house where drugs are sold, or a bar where fights often occur. Law-abiding citizens recognize and avoid these places, and law-breaking ones are attracted to them, creating a simple process of self-selection. Certain behaviors like the public possession of illegal firearms and substance abuse are the third factor. It may surprise you to know that liquor has a closer connection to homicide than illegal drugs. Its easy availability and ability to lower inhibitions is key. Homicides often happen after fights and arguments that have no immediate connection to criminal activity. Alcohol and guns become the key to escalating arguments to confrontations, to deadly conflicts. Put simply, a homicide is a tragedy that occurs at the interaction of problem people, places, and behaviors. Carrot and stick. In order to address hot spots and hot people, a range of incentives is required, both to promote positive associations and activities and deter violent ones. In Patrick Sharkey's book Uneasy Place, he shows that community nonprofits had an impact on reducing crime from 1990 to 2012. In a city with 100,000 people, every new nonprofit led to a 1% drop in violent crime rates. Community organizations play a substantial role in reducing violence and prove that there are ways to address violence that do less damage than traditional, tough-on-crime strategies. This isn't to say that law enforcement strategies are ineffective, only that neither tough nor soft approaches to crime have a monopoly on efficacy. Every city that has been successful in reducing urban violence has used a combination of both punishment and prevention. Social workers need to focus on potentially violent youth in order to help them avoid incarceration. Investments must be made in violent hotspots in order to permanently change them. Aggressive law enforcement must be limited to only the most dangerous of behaviors, like illegal possession of firearms. Overenforcement can lead to more arrests, but it may actually increase violence. 3. No justice, no peace. Today's America faces a national crisis of confidence in its criminal justice system. In order to understand the events of Ferguson and others, we must examine the relationship between the government and the governed, between institutions of criminal justice and the communities they serve. Safety cannot be guaranteed without legitimacy. The threat of violence comes with injustice. According to one legal theorist, legitimacy is recognizing the right of an authority to govern, justifying both their political power and obedience. When an authority is seen as legitimate, people will voluntarily obey, with no threats or incentive. Legitimacy can be described in two broad categories: effectiveness and fairness. Effectiveness is judged by whether the main objective of the law, keeping public safety and peace, is achieved. A government's authority cannot be respected if it cannot protect its citizens. Legitimacy depends on using the law effectively for that purpose. Fairness requires said law to be as dependable on the streets as it is on paper. Fairness is a requirement for both processes and results. Laws are justified when they are written in accordance with accepted processes, both democratic and constitutional. These laws must apply for all social and economic groups, and be enforced in accordance with widely accepted values like transparency and equality. As such, criminal justice officials cannot be legitimate unless they effectively address crime, obey the law themselves, and enforce the law in a fair manner. Often, individuals and institutions will fall short of fulfilling some, if not all of these. Illegitimacy and violence walk hand in hand. The most controversial uses of police force often occur in the most violent communities. Community cynicism. A community's trust is undermined when officials abuse their authority. The misconduct of a single officer is often enough to give an entire agency or institution a bad reputation. When people see that law enforcement is either unwilling or unable to help them, they withdraw and refuse to cooperate or testify in court. This legal cynicism encourages citizens to resort to self-rule via the code of the street, an informal and brutal system based on respect and payback. Violence soon follows. People who live in communities of concentrated poverty often complain about underpolicing and a lack of commitment toward solving serious crimes. The rate of violence is especially high in these places, and the clearance rate, or the rate at which perpetrators are charged and arrested, are especially low, too. In 2017, 4 out of 10 criminals got away with their crimes. Without information from the communities, the authorities cannot build their cases. This creates a dilemma. To improve safety, trust is needed, but to improve trust, safety is needed. Police cynicism. Legal cynicism is also a problem with the police. Police know better than most people that when it comes to urban violence, today's victim is often tomorrow's attacker. Police officers can be discouraged by the ineffectiveness they see within the criminal justice system. They see an institution starved for resources, where criminals rarely receive real punishment. Police officers can feel misunderstood and treated poorly, subjected to arbitrary disciplines from their departments, and criticism and abuse from their communities. A majority of police officers report becoming more cold and indifferent during their careers. This change in attitude unfortunately makes them more likely to endorse and participate in harsh and aggressive tactics. Much like communities, cynical officers are more inclined to enforce their own brand of street justice. From vicious cycles to virtuous circles, social control is a term used to describe the customs, values, and laws that maintain social order. Formal social control is practiced by the state through the justice system. Informal social control is practiced by the community when they use social pressure. Broadly speaking, people obey customs and laws because they believe that they need to. Most social control is informal. As a general rule, people don't steal, even if they could get away with it. In fact, regular citizens have a greater role to play in keeping the public peace of cities than police officers. Legitimacy is the bridge between formal and informal social control. When formal control is seen to be exercised lawfully, informal control is strengthened, which then reduces the need for more formal control. Put simply, when the police use their authority legitimately, they strengthen the community's ability to police itself. The law is at its most powerful when it is self-executing and self-perpetuating. One might even say that if the law needs to be enforced, then it has already failed. 4. Pacifying shooters. How do we stop shooters before they can even pull the trigger? Practice the principle of focus, balance, and fairness. First, focus only on would-be killers, and specifically on the behavior of violence. Aim for the right balance between rewards and sanctions. Offer help to stop the violent cycle, but threaten with punishment if it continues. Lastly, practice fairness by giving them a say in their own process of recovery, and treating them with respect and dignity. 3 anti-violence strategies exemplify these principles. These strategies usually operate independently from each other, but an ideal effort would align and connect all 3. 1. Focused deterrence. In Oakland, a partnership is formed between police prosecutors, key members of the community, and social service providers. They identify key groups, individuals, and dynamics that drive the violence in their community. One way to do this is through social network analysis. Start with one homicide victim, identify everyone they had criminal connections to, and repeat the process until you create a network of high-risk individuals. The more connections a person has within the network, the higher risk for violence. Once the relevant people and resources are gathered, the partnership of organizations meet them face-to-face, In group and individual meetings, the message is twofold: caring and consequences. At-risk individuals must feel like they are being treated fairly and given a clear choice, with the consequences being spelled out clearly by law enforcement. At its simplest, the message is this: we are here to help you. If you don't let us do that, then we are here to stop you. Key members of the community then stand to speak against violence, people with moral authority like elders and preachers, but most convincingly, mothers who have lost their children to violence. Service providers come in last, offering prompt and concrete assistance. Do these people need IDs or have open warrants? Do they need a place to stay or protection? Once the meetings end, the partnership must follow up on these people and follow through on the promises they made, keep at-risk people safe and out of jail, and then get them on a path to a better life. Failing that, offenders need to be held fully and visibly accountable. 2. Street outreach. Street outreach organizations directly interact with would-be shooters who traditional law enforcement or social services cannot reach. These workers are usually known and respected by the dangerous groups they work with, and are often ex-offenders who leverage their own street credibility. The primary objective of street outreach is to intercede in violent disputes before they turn into deadly conflict. Outreach workers can connect at-risk individuals to other forms of assistance and change a community's attitude towards violence through campaigning. Street outreach can happen anywhere. It is a high-pressure job that often takes a heavy toll on the workers. When formal social control fails, outreach workers use informal social control to stop violence. 3. Cognitive behavioral therapy. Violent behavior is often impulsive. Preventing it is a matter of keeping one's natural impulses in control. In lieu of adult role models, cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, is one of the best ways to temper those impulses. CBT has been used since the 80s as a treatment for addiction, anxiety, and depression, as well as criminal behavior. CBT is designed to make people more aware of their thoughts and the consequences of their actions, as well as empower them to make new strategies to control both. Concrete techniques like modeling and role-playing are used to provide feedback that help individuals make new choices and habits. CBT seems to be more effective when combined with other services, instead of on its own. Programs that are interested in increasing their effectiveness can incorporate CBT into their efforts. But this incorporation must be done seriously, and not as an afterthought. Concrete changes in thinking and behavior are the goal. Supporting someday shooters. While working with at-risk individuals is essential, care and attention must be placed towards someday shooters, children who might become at risk in the future. Disruptive and antisocial behavior as a child can lead to serious criminality in adulthood, but an early treatment can nip this problem in the bud. It is important that families are supported. A family must be healthy in order for a child to function. A strong bond with at least one caring adult is crucial. Home visiting and parent training programs are two strategies that seek to improve child outcomes by equipping caregivers. These usually involve health or social workers conducting at-home visits or hosting clinics with mothers in order to train them how to properly take care of their children. Functional family therapy, or FFT, is another form of intervention that has proven effective at curbing violence. Therapists provide intensive therapy to a child's entire family in order to correct patterns of interaction that contribute towards poor behavior. Together, caretakers and children learn about communication, conflict resolution, and problem-solving skills, which they can then apply towards other areas like school and the community. Putting away bona fide shooters. When all else fails, unlawful violence needs to be met by lawful force in the form of incarceration. The unfortunate reality is that no prevention strategy works every time. If a chronic violent offender cannot be changed, then they must be stopped. 5. Talk and action. The way we talk about a problem affects how we solve it. The national dialogue about urban violence needs to be focused on solving problems, not on assigning blame, and certainly not on winning arguments. But at the same time, action needs to happen now. Even as we work to change the conversation in the narrative, we must get to work for the poor urban communities that desperately need relief. Rejecting race-based rhetoric, there is an enduring narrative that urban violence is mainly a black problem. While African Americans are several more times likely to be the victims and perpetrators of homicide, characterizing urban violence as black-on-black violence is misleading. Violence as a whole mainly happens between members of the same race. 84% of white homicide victims were killed by a white person, but this violence is not labeled as white on white. Violence is no more inherently black than financial crime is inherently white. While there is socioeconomic context that violence is promoted among concentrated poverty, the vast majority of any race is uninvolved. Both black and white people largely live crime-free lives, but only Black people have an assumed association with violence. There is an underlying assumption that urban violence is the result of general lawlessness that is enabled by a community's tolerance for criminality. This is not true. Most African American people, even the ones who live in poverty, share the same moral standards as the rest of the population. Those who have lived with ineffectiveness and unfairness in the justice system may be cynical, but this should not be confused for immorality. Black-on-black proponents argue that African Americans are at fault for urban violence, and therefore it is their responsibility to stop it. These arguments are weaponized to pardon society as a whole from responsibility, and places the weight of solving these issues on the backs of the communities who suffer from them the most. Embracing efforts to curb urban violence. The recent rise of progressive criticism of the U.S. criminal justice system is important and necessary, but for the sake of the vulnerable, that system must be improved, not removed. The people who are the most affected by the system's injustices are also the people who need the system the most. Painting institutions with a broad brush is neither fair or accurate. While there are some officials that are clearly racist, corrupt, and brutal, they do not represent the entire group. When the system fails, it must be held accountable, but in a way that results in positive change, not poisoned relationships. Showing what works. When it comes to violent crime, the reality stands that most people are woefully unaware of what actually keeps the peace. Evidence-informed strategies aren't capable of simplifying the complexity of urban violence, and as such can be difficult to understand, or even be outright challenging to the general public's sensibilities. As such, they are often overlooked in favor of solutions that can be evaluated using intuition and common sense. The media contributes to this by telling what we want to hear, instead of what we need to know. Sadly, quick fixes and easy answers don't do much good. The good news is that we have a large body of scientific research on urban violence. The bad news is that most of it is hidden behind publisher paywalls and academic jargon. Too much research is produced in a bubble, separate from the lives of people with actual exposure to violence and crime. It's hard to convince people to be excited for any of this. The idea that cities should target the highest risk places and people a select few instead of the public as a whole can be a hard pill to swallow. At first glance, these approaches might even seem unfair, especially when they do not prove to be immediately successful. Proportionality also comes into play here. Common sense suggests that big problems require big solutions. Urban violence comes at a tremendous cost to the public, but because it is highly concentrated within a few people and places, it is actually considered small in terms of policy. That we need to do a lot in order to solve a little can be hard to believe. The media thrives on sensationalized, polarizing stories, especially when it comes to everyday violence. They must do a better job of getting the word out on successful strategies and treatments, as well as the science that supports them. Making a new constituency. If you've ever experienced real violence for yourself, you know that ideology comes at a distant second place to solutions. Poor communities of color want an end to income inequality, discrimination, and lack of opportunity, but they desperately want to live in peace. Now, standard answers like it's all about culture, poverty, or guns appeal to supporters on the right or the left, but they offer little in the way of actual relief. There is no ready-made constituency for successful anti-violence strategies, so one must be created. The good thing is that this group doesn't need to be large. It just needs to be loud. A massive shift in public opinion is not necessary to gain support for evidence and community-informed strategies. We just need to change enough hearts and minds to support those who are already deeply and truly dedicated to advocating for anti-violence policies that are focused, balanced, and fair. We need a small but committed group of peacemakers that will demand serious solutions to urban violence. This is a relatively small request of our government, but the request must be made over and over again, until it is answered. Politicians must understand the consequences of failing to address urban violence. Journalists must be trained to hold officials accountable. Communities must be engaged in a way that ensures their political support comes at the condition that concrete commitments are met. Whether you prefer to read or listen, we have something for you. Visit bestbookbriefings.com now for more summaries.